Welcome to Explainable AI. We're demystifying digital minds as your personal journey into the heart of artificial intelligence. I'm Paul Anthony Claxton. I'm an AI venture capitalist and serial entrepreneur. After a decade of service in the Marine Corps, I was captivated by the power of battlefield technologies, which is where I was inspired to dive into the world of enterprise technology. My commitment is ultimately to make a meaningful difference in the world, which has led me to venture capital, where I view capital as a powerful tool to drive positive change. I'm recognized as a thought leader in AI and venture capital, and I regularly share my insights through podcasts and articles on major platforms like IdeaScale and the AI Accelerator Institute. You can learn more about me through my personal curriculum vitae website, www.paulclaxton.io. And to my co-host, Rohan Hall. Rohan?
Hey, so my name is Rohan Hall, and I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've been building tech since the beginning of time. And my focus recently is really taking a lot of that knowledge and put it into AI courses to teach businesses how to leverage AI to build their business, to build their brand, to gain efficiency with your business utilizing AI. So that's a current focus. I have also recently created a foundation called the Ninja CEO. And this is really to teach underprivileged youth and young adults how to use AI to help get ahead versus falling behind with their life and their career. And finally, we're releasing a new platform called Podcast Monster. And this is really cool. It's really allowing podcasters to have a new distribution system using AI agents to take their podcast and put it out into the world. But you can find out about all those things. Just go to rohanhall.com. That's my first name, last name, rohanhall.com. And you can find out about all these cool things that I'm working on right now. Paul?
Thanks, Rohan. And with that being said, so I want to get into our guest today. Omid, we're so glad to have you here. And we'd like to just kind of give you a second before we go into the dialogue of what we're going to talk about today. If you just please take a few moments to introduce yourself and your background and things that you're doing today.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here with some powerhouse hosts like you two. In the presence of greatness. So thanks for having me. I appreciate it. If you check me out on LinkedIn, you'll see that my headline bio says that I'm the coolest lawyer ever. And oftentimes people will ask me why I'm the coolest lawyer ever. And, there's a lot of different reasons. One reason is people have always called me the coolest lawyer ever. And for a long time, it really confused me. And then eventually I decided, I heard it so many times that I was just going to embrace it. I was going to adopt it as my own. And so that's one reason why I'm the coolest lawyer ever. Another reason why I'm the coolest lawyer ever, I just really like kindness. And I think that's cool. Like just being kind to people and like being welcoming and like a friendly person, I think is, another reason that makes me cool. And then, I've climbed some mountains. I've done some meditation retreats. I think that I have a great sense of humor personally. And then of course, like the fact that, I'm in tech and I am all about software and, the cool, exciting, up and coming gadgets and technology and that sort of thing also just makes me super cool as well. And the fact that I've like closed hundreds of millions of dollars in deals, I think is also pretty cool as well. So I'm the coolest lawyer ever. I am the managing partner at Optimus Legal, which is my law firm. We are a small boutique law firm, made up of a number of software attorneys, technology attorneys from some of the world's greatest law firms, Fenwick, White & Case, so on and so forth. You know, I've worked with groups like Plug and Play, 500 startups, some heavy hitters in the tech and startup space. And that's, you know, where my background comes from. I've almost 10 years as a software and technology lawyer, specifically doing venture capital, helping companies start up, helping companies scale, and helping companies exit. So those are the primary areas that I focus on. And now, you know, we have a number of AI clients at the law firm. I don't think that there's anywhere, you can't walk outside without a AI bird pooping on you and it being an AI company. So that's just the age that we're in now. So I'm here. I'm excited to talk about AI, and dive into the various topics that, you know, whatever comes up. It's going to be a magical surprise for everyone out there to follow this conversation on AI, but I'm very excited.
That's awesome. Awesome, Omid. I don't typically think of lawyers as being super cool, but you seem super cool.
Thanks. Thanks,
really
Paul.
Cool. And I bet you drive like a really cool car. And you're just fun to hang out with in general.
Thanks, so, man. Thanks.
But yeah. Well, let's go into the dialogue. Rowan, did you have any thoughts with opening up the conversation around what we're going to discuss today around AI?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's all kind of legal things that are really, really relevant with AI. And I think that we can really get into some of those things, whether it's stuff about compliance or data ownership or liability, all these kind of things. So I think we just go through and just have a nice, you know, friendly conversation. And let's just see how cool the cool lawyer is going to be with the responses. And but I think, you know what? If you're into tech and you're into AI, you've got to be cool. That's what I think. Anyway. So I'll let you start off, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think when it comes to, AI today, one of the biggest concerns is, you know, what do we own? It seems like we don't own anything anymore. And because of that, there's a lot of risk and kind of initiatives that are a lot of risks that are being uncovered. And because of those risks, we now have, you know, initiatives, we have new products popping up and new initiatives just with at the political level, at the organizational level that are popping up, ultimately because of the ownership dilemma in AI and the compliance, vulnerabilities that produces, right? And so leading off of that, you know, what I think what I want to ask is, you know, data, is being referred to as kind of like the new oil, so mm-hmm. to speak. So how can AI companies ensure that they're staying compliant with data privacy laws and regulations, but at the same time, like also maximizing the value of their data to enhance their AI models and business, right? So, and I think in terms of maximizing the value of the data is increasing the ownership, right? But how do we stay compliant at the same time?
Totally. Yeah, great question. Love it. Data is 100% the new oil. We're seeing companies be able to leverage data to increase their profits, specifically by like modeling human behavior, like we saw with the Cambridge Analytica case with Facebook. If you guys are familiar, it was the big scandal that put Zuck under the microscope, and he caught a lot of heat that ultimately resulted in like this kind of cool guy transformation that we're seeing with Zuckerberg, interestingly enough. But yeah, to answer your question, the most important thing for companies with respect to compliance is just making sure that they follow the laws with respect to data collection. And one of the primary, the number one
requirement to follow any of the laws, any of the data protection laws, is explicit consent. You need to, you know, be obtaining user consent from people when you are collecting their data. They need to be consenting to the collection of their data. I think that right out the gate, I don't think there's a way that you can run a software company that is collecting data from people and you not get people's consent. That's like, you know, one of the easiest ways to run afoul of success in general. I think another really important compliance aspect with respect to data that's going to be quite important, especially for GDPR, is data usage. You can't say that you're going to use the data for one thing and then use it for another thing. So you actually need to be very clear with explicit consent, making sure that you're getting consent from people to collect their data. Then you need to be very clear about how you're going to be using that data and strictly comply with that data usage that you say that you're going to use that data for. Other things that companies need to be aware of as well are things like anonymizing the data, pseudonymization of the data are also essential for maintaining compliance as well. And with respect to like training AI models, that's going to be important as well. Actually, there was when GDPR was rolled out, Google actually got hit with a $50 million fine for non-compliance with GDPR specifically. And so, you know, it's not something to be toyed with. It's not something to be played with. There are actual real risks for companies in data collection. It can cause, you know, quite big problems for them. Sometimes the fines that they can face are as large as 4% of world global revenue. So, you know, the risk and damage is great to a company for not following these compliance procedures. But just to wrap up, you know, this point, having a really robust data governance framework is really important. Mapping your data flows, mapping your permissions and consent, and obviously, you know, working with a legal team, legal provider, someone who really understands, you know, data protection and privacy, incredibly important.
Those are all very helpful. One thing that I want to ask though is, you know, what does consent look like? Because you know, say for example, if you're Google and you're collecting data in the same like kind of categorical data, so to speak, say for example, how does like in HR facility or the HR profession, how do they interview, hire, and fire? As it relates to maybe the manufacturing industry versus maybe the healthcare industry, so to speak, right? So the way that you provide that consent is going to, especially for like larger market companies that have such a diverse client base or and partner base, the way that you architect that consent explicitly is going to look very different. Yep, for each industry, right? And for it's sure. going to be interpreted differently as well. So what does that consent look like? Is that a disclaimer that we click on that you know, or is that some kind of is it in a fine print? Is it something that we read on a website, et cetera? What does that look like?
Yeah, great question. So I mean the most typical way to obtain consent, you know, is going to be the click wrap agreement. The click wrap agreement is when you go to create an account with, mm-hmm. you know, whatever platform provider that you're wanting to sign up with, a requirement of registering your account with that provider is that you have to agree to their terms of use. And they're, you know, the big complaint that everyone always has is their terms of use are like 100 pages long. No one reads it. Yeah, but that's usually the easiest way to obtain consent is making it part of your user flow at the time of registration. And to answer your question, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily different industry by industry. There are just some industries that are more highly regulated with respect to data collection than others. Obviously, healthcare, you know, is the one that comes top of mind as a result of HIPAA, as a result of the HIPAA protections, you know, which are very specific protections that apply to personal information. So,
very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, it could go really deep with the stuff you just talked about. I'm coming from the blockchain world, and so many people that I know will just not even put their data anywhere anymore. And so because one of the big issues is ownership, right? So who owns it? So Europe tried to, you know, have an impact with GDPR, which American companies just don't care about for the most part, unless, you know, they feel that they have European, you know, customers, unless you live in California where you have
the CCPA,
is it called? CCPA, yes. Which is really a copy of GDPR. So from a there's a data privacy thing, but there's a data ownership thing, right? And so that's one of the things that we're seeing more and more concerns about is that who really owns the data, right? And so this is where like the terms and conditions just kind of like go a little bit wacky that nobody reads, okay? And so so my question regarding that is you know, with the AI system increasingly rely on vast amount of data, how should businesses ethically handle data ownership? And I mean ownership, not just, you know, the normal like stuff. Who owns it? Do I own my data? How can I own my data, right? Does GDP help you with data ownership, or is it just kind of like how you can use the data, right? There's a difference, right? And there are more and more applications that I see are evolving now to have that, you know, that to have a greater control of their data versus automatically giving ownership of the data to these companies. So what's going on in that space, and how can consumers protect themselves, and what's the legal and ethical ramification for businesses?
Well, this is a really big conversation, Rohan, because, you know, while we say that data is the new oil, and, you know, companies are profiting off the data, I think that the people out there, for the most part, there's like a resignation with respect to the fact that our data is being exploited. Mm-hmm. And I think that people, because, you know, the terms and conditions are, you know, so long, and there isn't really a clear solution for the consumers who like are the suppliers of oil pretty much to actually protect their data from being exploited and monetized. Because if data is the new oil and the data is ultimately ours and we are supplying it to these companies that are taking it and profiting off of it, there isn't really like a clear mechanism. There isn't a clear channel. There isn't a clear pathway for the average consumer to understand like, oh, here are my options in terms of what I can do with my data so that my data is not being exploited. There really is no solution for the modern consumer right now for them to participate in this data market. They're just out there giving their data away.
Well, there are solutions being built. Like I know different companies that are working on that to have more decentralized ownership of data, and where you'll be able to actually own your data, control your data, control how the data is used, control the monetization of the data. So those things are being built right now. But for the current state of things where the large, especially Silicon Valley companies, by default, own and control the data, What are the ethical responsibilities do they have? And also, you know what? Do they really even typically try to follow GDPR? Just kind of curious question myself, because I don't think they do.
Well, so the large companies, I mean, have whole data and privacy teams that, you know, there usually is a data protection officer that has to be, you know, situated in a GDPR country or, you know, wherever the data protection laws are applicable. And I think that the large companies, like, you know, to answer your question of do they actually follow GDPR, I think the risk of not following GDPR if you have European customers is so great that I think that the big companies, as we saw with Google, for example, you know, being hit with the $50 million fine, which ultimately for Google, like, isn't that much. Like, $50 million is kind of a drop in the bucket for Google at the end of the day. But at the same time, I would imagine that they don't want to be paying $50 million fines too regularly. So, you know, there is incentive in the form of a stick, as in they'll, you know, get hit with a stick if they don't follow GDPR. So the big companies, I think, you know, do really make a concerted effort to comply with GDPR for the most part. You know, do they, are they in 100% compliance with the requirements of GDPR? I have yet to find any company that is 100% in compliance with, you know, any or all of the law, any law, you know. So that's just not the nature of how things work. But I do think that they're, for the large companies, they obviously have great incentive to, you know, follow some level of compliance with GDPR to keep them off of the radar, you know, of the regulatory agencies. And so that's what I to answer your question about whether, you know, the companies, the big companies follow GDPR. And then the ethical considerations. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's like big conversations here. I'm of the mind, and I'm curious what your guys' thoughts are. I think that the most important thing is that companies are clear about what they're going to do with the data, how they're going to collect the data, and it's up to the customer. Listen, I said that there aren't many pathways for customers to know how to have ownership over their data, but there is a very clear pathway. The pathway is this: if you don't want your data to be collected, you don't use the platforms. Like, that's the easiest way to retain control over your data. There's no way that you can use any of the large platforms and not give them your data. So you really only have the option of not participating, not engaging, not, you know, being a part of those platforms if you want to protect your data. So right now, that is the clearest pathway at this point in time. And I think the ethical considerations of the businesses are, listen, you know, we're a company, we want to be competitive, data is the way that we do it. And so if you're going to, you know, play on our network, this is what we're going to do with your data, this is how we're going to use it. And, you know, having auditable processes, and, you know, making sure that the data is protected, you know, and having those multiple layers of protection that are necessary, you know, to protect against hacks and so on and so forth, leaves the ball in the court of the customer to know that if I'm on this platform, this is, my data is going to be collected, and this is how it's going to be collected. And by participating, I consent. And I think that is the ethical obligation of the company personally. What are your guys' thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, so I want to transition for a second back to data ownership and compliance. I always thought that, you know, transparency and getting out of black box AI and getting into a mode of explainable AI is a lot like ingredients on a jar of goods, on a package of food, right? We don't know what monosodium triglyceride or what any of that crap is. We don't know what it is. And that's exactly the thing. It's like, You know, when you go and you click on, you acknowledge the fine print on a website, and you acknowledge that they're going to be using your data in a particular kind of way. You know, no one's going to spend time getting into the minutiae and the details of reading all of that fine print. We want to get right to the site and go what we came there for, right? So that's number one. Number two is, you know, I think the other issue is, you mentioned before that we have the option of not using that particular product or service or website or whatever. But the thing is that these larger companies, they know that's not going to happen, right? It's say, for example, like fast food. You have the option of not going and putting poison into your body. You have that option. You have the option of not going and eating fast food every day, but we do it anyway. Why? Because it's easy, because it's quick, right? Because we don't have time in our busy lives to go and, you know, cook a full-blown meal from scratch. So I think that's the other issue. And I want to get into my next question off of that, because I think there's a connection here about AI and liability and how do we protect against errors when AI makes a mistake or goes rogue or whatever? Who's liable? You know, I think we have to look at, you know, how much is the human involved in the process, human in the loop, and who, how many parties are involved in the process. I think it's almost kind of like insurance, right? You want full coverage insurance, not liability, because when you go out and you pull onto the highway to make a right turn, but there's another car coming down that is speeding, you know, maybe 70 in a 50 mile an hour zone. Well, who's at fault? Well, you shouldn't have made the right turn because it said no turn on red. But yet the other car is coming down doing 20 miles an hour over the speed limit. You're both in the wrong, you know? And so I think at that point you want to have kind of like a full coverage situation going on. But at the same time, what we have to do, I think, is leaders in the industry and AI, to reduce situations like that where we're seeing AI make errors, is, you know, we do have to ensure that, number one, there's a high level point of comprehension in terms of how that data is being used. If I'm an organization and I'm white labeling AI, I have to know at a high level of comprehension how that data has been used, so that I can know that when I white label it, okay, there's a chain of events of usage here. The data has like a paper trail, right? And so then I'm not putting my consumers, my clients at risk. So I think you have to have a high level of comprehension. That's number one. I think you have to have full coverage on both ends, both on the human side and on the AI side. And then thirdly, I think we have to make it more explainable. So when we go and we look at, okay, you know, what are we clicking on here? When I decide to give my information to this website, what am I clicking on? Put it in bullet point form. You know, don't list out all the ingredients like we do on food products, but literally tell me what this means so that a 5-year-old can understand it. So really those 3 points.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't understand actually why there is a conversation where liability isn't understood to be squarely placed on the creator of the product. You know, it's like, okay, let's take the example of an autonomous vehicle. You know, we're seeing, I don't know if you guys have heard this or not, but like Waymo in San Francisco has been running over pedestrians.
Was it just one time or more than one time?
I know for sure it was one time. Uh-huh. I think it might be more than one time. Don't quote me on it. I know for sure it happened one time, but okay. There have been, okay. Even with the, you know, the Tesla autonomous driving, you know, when people go mm-hmm. on self-driving mode, there have been, you know, these weird instances where the light will reflect
you know, some strange way, it will glitch out the vehicle. And as a result, the, you know, the vehicle gets into an accident. That's a product manufacturing, like that's a bug, you know? If you hire someone to build your house and they build the roof of your house faultily, and the roof of your house falls on your head, the person who built your house is going to be liable for the shoddy work that they did in building your house. If you go and you buy a car and the wheels of the car fall off and you cause, you know, a 10 car pileup, and there's a manufacturing issue, the manufacturer is liable for the issue that they, it's simple product liability. I think that this is no different. I think that the liability is, and the onus is on the person who's creating the product. And so if you're putting a product out there and that product is causing harm and is causing damage, whether it's, you know, misdiagnosing, or, you know, it's causing accidents, or it's, you know, leading to like poor financial results as a result of this product that you created, then, you know, why wouldn't the liability be on you? It's important, and it should be, because it's a great responsibility to create these products. A lot of people are relying on them, and so companies, I'm very company friendly, you know, I'm a business lawyer and I represent businesses, and I feel like it's important, you know, the product that you're putting out there, you should be confident in the product that you're putting out there. You should put it out there acknowledging and recognizing that the necessary time, effort, and energy has been spent to getting this product to a place that you know that you can take it to market. So that's what I think.
I think I'd follow up with that with a, so I teach businesses how to use AI, right? And one of the things I've learned is that most people have no clue what they're doing, right? And so every time I hear somebody talk about hallucination, 99% of the time is that they just don't know what they're doing. They're writing terrible prompts. They're not educated with that. And I always use the example of when I was really young, a teenager or something, there was a TV series called The Greatest American Hero. There's this fuzzy blonde hair guy that an alien gave him a super suit, and he couldn't figure out, he didn't know what to do with it, but he knew he had superpowers. And I think one day he was falling off a building, he was like, and then he was like, oh my God, I can fly. And he kind of figured that he could fly halfway. And then he was trying to stop some robber or something. He was like, just been hiring a guy. And they started shooting him like, oh my God, I'm bulletproof, right? And I kind of look at AI as that, where we all have this new superpower, right? But people don't know how to use it well, and they get into trouble, and then they blame the AI, okay? Or they may blame the product that used that AI. So I think the way that I would have a follow-up question would, from what Paul was saying, is that if in those situations where a customer is contracting an AI company, like I have an AI company, we make sure we're covered, right? But is that something that should be in the contract then, to say, hey, we do what we're doing, but you need to do it the right way? Or, I mean, should there be something structured in a contract to clearly state who is, because it could be, is it the end customer? Is it the product? Is it the model? Like, for example, we use OpenAI stuff in some of the products that we're building, and sometimes it just flakes out, you know? And it just does, right? Is it their fault if somebody's making a decision based on something that I'm building, that I'm relying on that? Is it, so they're like multiple parties. So from a legal point of view, how should those agreements be structured then? Who's really at fault with that?
I love the way you just parsed that, because while the company should be responsible for the product, they obviously can't be responsible for people relying on the outputs of the AI, because obviously the outputs of the AI are related to the user, right? So as you pointed out, like the user, if the user doesn't know how to prompt the AI, then, you know, the output that is going to be given, you know, it impacts the output. Disclaimers, I think, are absolutely necessary. And actually, I want to tie this back to what I said previously. I think that there are instances where the company should be responsible for the product. And I think at the end of the day, if you put out an AI product, and even if you use the correct types of prompts and the output gives misinformation, or, you know, where these instances of hallucination happen, then ultimately, yes, the company should be responsible for that. I think that there is, as Paul pointed out in his example of, you know, the person doing the right turn at a red light and then someone speeding and crashing into them, there is some shared liability there. And I think AI companies, you know, already disclaim a lot of the outputs, you know, there always is some sort of disclaimer that says like, hey, you know, this information may or may not be accurate. Always make sure and double check, fact check, you know, the outputs of this artificial intelligence system. So those disclaimers exist. And then I think on the company side as well, you know, any prudent company that works with legal counsel is going to have things like limitation of liability, for example, in their contracts, so that if something were to happen and a person were to be damaged by relying on the output of the AI, you know, the amount of damages that person can collect from the company is going to usually be limited. Typically, the limitation is like whatever the contract value is or whatever has been paid in the last 12 months, for example. And so to answer your question of should companies look to protect themselves contractually, you know, through disclaimers, absolutely 100%. And then also making sure to use things like limitation of liability clauses in their contracts will help limit their liability for, you know, any damages that may arise. But I still do think it's important in the instances like with these like self-driving cars and things like that, you know, that's not user error. That's like 100% just programmatic issues. Or if it like results in a misdiagnosis, for example, in the healthcare instance. Yeah, I think liability there is much clearer, as opposed to, you know, some user prompting, you know, some AI platform and getting an output that results in damage where they could contribute to those damages. It kind of reminds me of, I'm not a personal injury lawyer by any means, but in the world of personal injury, there are some states that use something called a contributory negligence approach to determining liability, where it's like, oh, okay, you know, this person crashed into this person, and you know, this sort of the set of facts that you presented, Paul, in that instance, you know, they might find that the guy that was speeding was 20% liable, and the person that turned right on red was 80% liable. And so based on that, they'll like balance the impact of damages based on the, you know, the contributory liability. Whereas like other states will say, no, you know, yes, the person turned right on red, and you know, they weren't supposed to do that. And so, you know, it's like zero liability. It's either zero or 100% liability pretty much. So these are kind of like the different frameworks and models. And it's going to be interesting to see how the states start to apply these sorts of kind of models for liability in these instances.
Very interesting. You know, I think, you know, when, so what we're trying to do right now, there's a mix of efforts to move AI forward there. And part of that is capitalism and part of it is consumerism, right? But you can't have one without the other, because in order for AI to exist in the form of capitalism, we have to consumerize it. But in order to consumerize it, we have to get it into the hands of consumers, right? Which means that we, you know, we need more computing ability. You know, we need AI to be more sustainable. We need more data. We need more AI literacy, all those things. And because we don't have a lot of that, you know, a lot of people are saying AI is dangerous. But at the same time, you know, humans tend to be prone to negativity. We have to work to be positive. It's just in our nature, right? So, you know, at the same time, AI is doing some wonderful things on the other end, right? And I think, you know, with all that being said, we have to look at what companies are really most investable when it comes to AI, right? And I think when you see, you know, a fundamental technology like this that's going to change everything from the top to the bottom in terms of how we live and work, you're going to see a lot of policy. You're going to see a lot of government involvement. And so, you know, being a former Marine myself, you know, I think it's important to look at what the government is looking to do with AI, what is happening, you know, at the organized community level, all the way from your local city councils up to the White House. It's important to look at that in terms of what companies right now are fundable and what companies are not, because I don't think that it is wise for, you know, any Joe Schmo out of his garage, his or her garage, to just be building some sort of AI and releasing it out into the wild untrained. Like, I mean, it's insane. And but that's what's happening. And so I think, you know, if we want to look at reducing errors and some of the liability that the AI can create in the collateral damage, I do think that, you know, it's important that some of these are funded from a dual use, dual tech type of approach. You know, I think, so when I was in the Marine Corps, we used to test our weapons on what we call proving grounds. Proving grounds is nothing more than a large area of unadulterated land, uninhabited land, usually in the middle of the desert where you have clear skies. And we just drop bombs all day, you know, and we would go out there in the desert and do these 2 to 3 month exercises and just drop bombs and play war games, you know. And I think that's kind of what like AI is, right? We do that in, you know, a mock testing environment where we can just let AI run wild and it doesn't hurt anyone, you know, but the government has the ability to do that. So, you know, with that being said, you know, I think there's two sides to what's a fundable company. You know, we can only regulate this at the organizational level so much when we're consumerizing it. What we have to do is we have to create laws, just like car companies are regulated in the way that they manufacture cars. But the real laws that govern how cars are managed in our society are on the road. They're on the road. And so with that being said, you know, we have to look at creating laws for everyday people like you and me about what we're actually doing with AI, because I can go on Facebook, I can go on any social media platform, and I can see something that's not real, a celebrity that is having their likeness misused. And that should be illegal, but it's not right now. And so, you know, I think we have to look at, okay, what's fundable? And, you know, if it poses a danger or a threat to us, then how do we maybe, you know, move that? That's a powerful technology, but how do we release it in a phased model, in a controlled model, when we don't have the regulations to do that, right? And I think, you know, we can look at the DoD to that. We can look at government organizations to do that. So those are just some of kind of my thoughts. Once again, I'm going to sit on the fence and be indecisive. And I'm going to say, okay, I've expressed some of my viewpoints, but what do you think is the most, you know, is a fundable company in terms of AI versus maybe not?
I'm actually curious what Rohan thinks. What do you think, Rohan?
Put me on the spot.
Come on now.
See, like, so I tell you why this is a really cool conversation, right? We have a lawyer, we have a VC, and we have an entrepreneur. Okay. So it's kind of like, let's get some beer. Let's talk about like our different perspective, right? My perspective is a little bit different. And the way that I would frame the question a little bit differently is that I think everybody should be out there building AI, right? I really, really do. And my concern is not about that. My concern is that one small group of people control all of that, and they all live in Northern California, okay? Mm-hmm. And I have a problem with that, right? And I've lived in the Bay Area. It's great. And every time a VC tells me about how much money there is out there and everyone, you know, it's so easy, I want to choke them, because I'm like, guys, you know, get the F you, you know, out of the Bay Area and go anywhere else, right? And so for me, from an entrepreneurial point of view, I would be more interested in not worrying about people building AI. I'm more interested in more people having access to funding to build AI, right? If I'm in the Bay Area, I can go into almost any bar, but I can go into a bar, I can stand at the bar, I can order a beer, right? And there's a high chance the guy or girl, whomever is standing next to me I'm talking to, work for some startup that is funded by some big VC company, right? And I can have the conversation and I can get introduced to somebody, okay, that could help me with funding, right? So just by being in that environment, I think you have like a significantly higher chance of having a successful startup project just because you're surrounded by it. But if you're in Kansas, if you're in Boulder, Colorado, if you're in, you know, Miami, if you're in almost anywhere else, and don't even mention if you're not even in the United States, right? So my challenge is that there's a small group of people that's running this world. It's been like this for a while, and then now it's like AI, which I find that to be more dangerous than some guys in the basement someplace else that doesn't have the money to do that, right? So, so I don't really have the answer to. I have more for a question than an answer, so it may not be great in responding to what you're saying there. But my concern about the funding piece of this, which is kind of like what I think we're talking about essentially, is that I would want to know, and I'd want to answer for people that are watching this, right? Because part of the point, my solution is. I've created a foundation. I'm in the middle of creating that foundation for people that are in underserved communities and on the privilege that they won't, most of them won't watch that, right? Because they're not in that circle. So I'm actually have a different podcast targeting that, right? And a foundation targeting that, because I want to have a wider, I want the net to be cast wider, right? Regarding that, so that we can have more input, okay? You know, I would, I would mention some VC that company's name, but I don't want to be banned forever from Silicon Valley events, right? That I don't really agree with some things. So my point would be more of, I believe that there's a small group of people, in and I'll point it out in Northern California, that controls practically everything that goes on with AI right now, and they have an undue amount of power and influence, even in the elections of our country right now, and I won't even get into that, right? And I would like to, I would like for there to be a greater effort, to spread that wealth and spread that influence across the USA for more Americans to be educated. And there are laws right now. There's a law in Congress called the AI Literacy Act that will contribute towards that, and it'll probably get passed maybe next year or something. It's a bipartisan law for education. So there are going to be things that are in the play, but that would be more of my concern. So my concern is it's maybe similar to Paul, but it's from a different perspective. Because I'm an entrepreneur, I'm not an investor in the VC. I've raised millions in the past, so I understand the process, right? I've done an exit, I've gone through all that stuff, right? So I get it. But my concern is, my God, this thing it's already changing the world. It will change the world. And a bunch of guys in Silicon Valley is deciding this for the rest of the world. So that concerns me more than anything else.
Got it. Yeah, so I'm going to take a different angle than both of you.
Right.
And Paul, the question that you had asked was, given the landscape, what makes a fundable company is essentially what you had asked with respect
Yeah.
to AI. Yeah.
And I think there's two ways you can go with that. It's the route that we're currently heavily pressed towards, which is consumerism. There's the dual use, dual tech route where we can shield people from, the threat from the screw ups that can happen with AI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with the same question, my part of it is that what Paul said, but where people outside of Silicon Valley can participate in that fundability of the company.
Well, here's what I think. I've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs. I'm a 2x software founder myself. I also have raised, capital for not only other businesses but my own as well. And I think that the number one complaint for entrepreneurs about venture capitalists hasn't changed as a result of AI. The number one complaint is the things that make a business fundable are not the things that, the traditional VC often looks for in funding the business. Things like product market fit, like, making sure that you're actually profitable, for example, or at least have like some sort of like a, transparent, viable business model. So, what do I think makes a company profitable, or what makes a company investable? What makes a company investable is like a strong founding team, a knowledge of the market, a clear business plan, a pathway to profitability, product market fit, finding a distribution channel that like acquires customers at a cost that makes sense in relation to the lifetime value of the customer, for example, so that they can make it to profitability. Like, these are the factors that I think make a successful business, and those should technically be the factors that make venture capital investors invest, but that just traditionally has not been the case for why VCs invest. The number one complaint for so many entrepreneurs about VCs are hype chasers. They go after the thing that's sexy, that's exciting. Doesn't matter if it doesn't have a business model. If you slap a name onto it and, make it seem cool and like it's going to be transformative or whatever, even if it's like super outlandish, it'll get investment. Meanwhile, like, there are really strong entrepreneurs out there that have incredibly investable businesses, but maybe they're, not sexy or flashy or whatever it is, and those people don't, get the investment. And to your point, Rohan, in terms of, the underserved market, You know, the solution there, and I'll tell you what I tell all of the entrepreneurs that I work with. What I tell all of the entrepreneurs that I work with is VC is not a business model. You cannot make raising capital a condition to you creating or operating your company. You just can't. If you're going to operate that way, it's going to be incredibly difficult for you to be an entrepreneur. Now, I know that the space is unfair. Like, the levels of equity in terms of how much equity people have in their capability to access available investment is not equal amongst, you know, location, demographic, so on and so forth. Not equal by any means. That's why it's so important as an entrepreneur, like, build a company that VCs like are begging you to invest in. That is the strongest place that any entrepreneur can be in. And I think access to capital is less important in those instances from my perspective, because it's like, cool, take your value proposition and go get, you know, your first 100 pre-launch customers. And then you could take that to a VC and be like, hey, look, I got 100 people to pay me, you know, $199, you know, for an annual subscription to this thing that I want to launch. Now you at least have some validation. Do a crowdfunding campaign. There are various other ways to make it so that, like, VC is not a condition to running your company, and you can be successful as a founder where it's not so necessary for VCs to be a part of it. And it makes it substantially easier to access and break into the VC market if you wanted to. So that's like what I would say. And I'm curious, Rohan, I know you are passionate about this, so I'm curious what you would say.
No, I totally agree with you, because I totally agree with you. And even the project I'm working on right now, I really have not looked at VC. I did speak to one guy. What's that say? That's so funny, just in case it's a friend. But I purposely not look for funding for this project, because I've gone through that route before. And I do believe that if you are able to be really resourceful, and you're able to, there are different ways you can build, being quite resourceful and at a very low cost and still have something, that people are willing to pay for. And it also gives you a chance to kind of like test your assumptions, right? And I've been going through that this year. And that's like, so some things are like, oh, let's fill around, and some things like, oh my God, I wish I knew that, right? And I think that I do agree. You know, I've been an entrepreneur for like more than a couple of decades, right? So I've tried it through all kind of things, right? So I think your answer was absolutely right on. I don't think it could have been said better. One example, I also teach people how to build, you know, like founders, how to build tech and how to go find money and all of that stuff, right? Because I've been doing it for a while. And one of the things, one of the first things also to people that want funding, I'll say, go watch Shark Tank and come back and tell me everyone that got money that walked in there without a product and or without customers, right? Because the first thing is like, you know, whether it's Mark Cuban or whatever. So what's your product? Are you not having the product? You wouldn't even get invited. So what's your attraction? Attraction, thank you, get out of here, right? You know, so I think there's some basic things, and I think if you can get there, I think you're right. I think investors are not risk takers, right? That's, I think, the surprising thing for a lot of people. You think investors are risk takers. They're the most conservative financial people that I've ever met, right? And so their thing is, get rid of all the risk and then I'll talk to you, right? And I think what you've really said is that would be the summary of it. Once you've gotten rid of all the risk, once you prove that there is interest, once people are paying you some money, once you have something that people want to buy, then you can go to them, and all they want to do is just throw fuel onto the fire, and then they can sleep better at night. So I agree with you 100% on that.
Awesome. Paul, what do you, any thoughts?
I think so. I think it's virtually impossible to get rid of all the risk. What I think it's really hard to pick winners and losers in venture capital. I don't believe in following the path that everyone, I don't believe in being a member of the herd and following the path that everyone else has. I mean, I've just look at my background and it's totally unconventional, right? And so I'm not afraid to go out on my own. Like I'm the entrepreneur of entrepreneurs, you know? And so I really don't give a crap about investing, you know, in a company because my friends did or because it's the new hot thing on the market. For example, one of our portfolio companies is doing something that's not even like that sexy. It's really not, but you know what? It's meaningful. It's going to progress. I call it like a I call it an underbelly technology of AI because what they're doing is they're eliminating the waste that happens that takes place during the production of AI. And that's really all I'm going to say. I'm not going to go into detail on it because I just don't want to. It's confidential. I get into the confidential stuff, but the point is that you know we know that AI produced a lot of waste during its production. So you know anything we can do to make it more sustainable and you know reduce the collateral damage that takes place, we should be doing that. Look at cars. You know when I was growing up as a boy in the 80s, when my dad would start his car, like I would damn near choke to death because you know the car was just like you know it didn't have like a catalytic converter and you know and just the fumes and everything. But now it's like today you start a car, it's like you don't get all that pollution, right? And so cars have gotten more sustainable and you know over the years you know they've gotten more environmentally friendly, and we can do that with AI too. You know, it's just going to take time. I would say the AI is not sustainable right now. So, not it the way, not in its current, not in its current character. It's not sustainable, but we can make it sustainable. So, and I think it's like Paul Virilio said, anytime you invent something, you create another problem. You know, it's like if we didn't have planes, we wouldn't have plane crashes and we wouldn't have all these other issues, right? That come with planes. But at the same time, they've allowed us to. I'm in Ireland. A few days ago, I was in Montreal. A few days before that, I was in Miami. You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, like when we couldn't do that without planes, right? And so, you know, I think we have to look at the opportunity cost, but we have to look at the upside and the downside of AI when we're talking about investing in companies. And I think that's the first thing that anyone needs to have in their mind is like, okay, you know, not who wants to buy this, not, you know, is it popular, not any of that crap, not the TAM, SAM, any of that. Is it solving a major problem? The bigger the problem it's solving, the more likely the company is going to be successful. The less let's see. I wouldn't necessarily say that competition is a bad thing. Sometimes having, you know, the second mover or a third mover, last mover's advantage is a good thing. Just look at MySpace, and then before that, there was Friendster, I think, and then you have Facebook, and they ate their lunch, right? And so, you know, you don't always have to be first. You just have to do it right. And so, you know, you have to find out as a founder and as an investor, where do you fit in? And then go for it. So, and then I think as an investor, you got to figure that out. And you got to figure out what is the character of the people that, you know, you're potentially going to be investing in? You know, because no matter how good the product is, you know, how good the problem is that they're solving, you know, if you're in the realm of nefarious characters, you know, people could be stabbing you in the back, you know, and there's not a lot of times as an entrepreneur, you're an investor, you're in a dark room, you know, so you got to be able to trust that you're being in a dark room, that people are not coming out to, like, you know, sabotage you because you can't see it. Right. And so you got to be able to trust each other. And so character is a big thing. So that those would be the things that I would look at personally.
Got it. Love it.
Yeah. I don't know if that helps.
Totally. That's your viewpoint on, you know, what makes a company investable and how investors should go about evaluating companies to invest in.
That's a great breakdown. Well, I mean, I think, you know, at the early stage now, you know, being a later stage, like, you know, like at the private equity level, I think that's a whole nother set of dominoes. So, I specialize in early stage.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome, guys. Wow.
Yeah. It's good chat.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
I think this has been really, really awesome. Really, really cool. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too.
So Paul, are we getting to the point we should be wrapping up?
I think we're getting there, unfortunately. Yeah. Omid, I want to ask, did you have any closing thoughts? And, you know, otherwise, you know, I think you're someone that our listeners need to know and that they want to know. So if you could just kind of, you know, let them know the best way to get a hold of you, if they want to get a hold of you, maybe for more interviews, who knows? Please do
it's
that.
It's just coollawyer.com, isn't it?
the coolest ever. No. Just joking. Listen, Rohan, Paul, really appreciate you guys having me on the show. For all the listeners out there, if you'd like to connect, I'm on LinkedIn. You can just search my name, Omid Tabai, on LinkedIn. Shoot me a message request. Shoot me a message. Would love to connect. I'm always here to, you know, bounce ideas. You know, just I'm here for relationship and connection. That's why it's been such a pleasure to be on the show here with Rohan and Paul, to have this like awesome conversation, this awesome connection that we're forming. I can't wait to see what you guys do with the show moving forward. Glad to be a part of it. And yeah, thanks again.
Really great to have you on the show. Listen, if you're a listener and you want to be a guest on one of our future shows, reach out to me on LinkedIn, Paul Anthony Claxton, or my co-host Rowan Hall. You can reach us on our personal websites listed at the beginning of this podcast as well. But otherwise, stay tuned for our next episodes. Thank you so much.